Conversations with Maria Menounos, podcast edition, inspiration.
Is there anything she can't handle? She looks fear in the face day after day, but yet she never runs. She's unbreakable. She's a warrior. She's you.
Growth.
But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward.
Community.
These things happen because you have to live your true self in a bigger way.
Featuring the best of Maria Menounos' SiriusXM show with celebrity and life-changing interviews, thoughts on the week, and more. And it's free. All we ask is that you rate, comment, and subscribe on iTunes and tell a friend to subscribe to SiriusXM. Listen to Conversations with Maria Menounos on SiriusXM Stars 109 at 1 p.m. East. And now here's your host, Maria Menounos.
Happy Friday. Little Kelly Clarkson coming at ya. I feel this is the first dance I had for Dancing with the Stars. This is this song.
No, I didn't know that. That's crazy.
I did the cha-cha.
That's insane.
I was the first contestant on the dance floor. I had to go number one, which was so scary. And I danced to this, which was amazing.
This is a great song.
It is. It had a lot of energy, so it really helped.
Yeah, it's
I was
timeless.
A little stiff, if you watch it back.
You were so good on... Actually, it was funny. I was watching your Dancing with the Stars moments a couple weeks ago. I don't know why I got into a rabbit hole of YouTube Dancing with the Stars, Maria Menounos. I think it's because I didn't watch it when you were on it. No offense. I just never watched Dancing with the Stars.
You didn't watch it when I was on it?
I didn't. I never watched it at all. I've never watched the show either. I've never just watched the show in general. I was like, wow, she's really good.
Thanks.
You have really good dance moves.
I had a really great teacher.
You did, yeah.
It was really cool watching.
I mean, it was like, wow, I got to experience it for the first time, kind of see what you did and what you wore.
Did you have a favorite?
The yellow dress. You had a yellow dress. It was beautiful. It was one of my favorites. And then you did another one. I think so, yeah. Then you had one where it was awesome. I think it was a red dress and you were,
I remember
the judges were like blown away by you guys.
Yeah, perfect you 10.
Were, yeah. That was a good one, too.
Yeah, that was the Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah,
the,
something like that.
Something Capulet's. I can't remember. Anyway, it was the Paso Doble.
Yes.
And
yes.
I was a vampire, and I bit him.
Yes. Yeah. It was awesome. This was a few weeks ago, so my memory. But yes,
such
it was great.
A good one. You know, it's funny. I used that dance. So that night when I danced the Paso Doble, I remember I would look down at Kevin and my parents in the audience from up above when they used to have everyone in that, you know, upstairs area. And I would usually look at him like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen tonight. Like just underconfident or nervous or whatever, because my feet were shattering before my eyes every week. And so I'm like, we'll see. And that night I just looked at him and I'm like, and I gave him like that. I got this, like this, I've got this. And I went out and nailed the dance with Derek. We got perfect tens. And I've used that moment to summon up powers in moments when I need confidence. So it's like, if you've ever had a moment where you've like really overcome something, like remember to store that in your memory bank and use it in the future. So I remember when I had to walk the fire at Tony Robbins seminar, I was so scared. And you're just sitting there and you're like, there's coals of flames right in front of you and you're about to walk on them with your bare feet. And I was terrified and I just mustered up that moment and I put myself in that moment, in that booth upstairs at the Dancing with the Stars, you know, ballroom. And I was like, I got this. And I remember that feeling and I lived in that feeling and I walked right through the flames.
Wow.
And on those coals. And when I got to the other side, I thought I had screwed up because it felt cold under my feet. And Mark Burnett was sitting on the other side of it. And he was like, he gave me a big hug. And I'm like, I screwed up. And he goes, what do you mean? I go, I felt cold under my feet. I must have ventured onto the grass. And he goes, you walked right down the middle so fiercely.
Whoa. So you didn't even know?
Yeah. I had channeled I had been so deeply in that other moment where I had the confidence because I didn't have it right here. And so I threw myself into that moment so deep that, I mean, it felt cold under my feet.
Okay, that's mind-blowing.
Kind of crazy, right?
That's so crazy.
So that's why I like when people challenge themselves, and that's what I've learned in my life. When you challenge yourself, you can see what you're kind of made of. And sometimes you'll succeed and sometimes you'll fail. But when you do have that one victory and you can remember that, like I remember even wrestling at WrestleMania and just – you know, you're riddled with fear and you're just, but once you get in that ring, like something takes over. And when you have that moment, when you actually achieve everything that you wanted to achieve, you're like, oh, I can remember this and I can access it again.
Yeah. Well, again, that's something that you're really, really good at, Maria. I just went back and watched all your matches.
On the Network.
I was blown away. I haven't watched them for so long. And it just, every aspect of it, you were so good.
Oh, thanks. I don't know if I was so good. I think that there was some divine forces helping along because I honestly, I don't even know. I was like out of body experience. Didn't even know I was in there. Like it just was happening. And I was wrestling with the greats and they made me look so good. But I remember in one of my matches before WrestleMania, I was wrestling Alicia Fox and I couldn't get up on her shoulder enough to flip her to do the sunset flip. So I have to position my hips on her shoulder so then I can go down under her butt and like roll her over, put my head like basically in her privates and flip her over. And I couldn't, I had to wiggle myself up higher. I was like, do not fail. Failure is not an option. This is what's going in through my head. And I'm like, wiggle, wiggle up. And then I wiggled up and I got through and I flipped her and it was awesome.
How much training did you go through for that? And are you doing it with the actual, like with someone like Alicia Fox, or are you doing it with someone else, like a stand-in or something beforehand?
No, I mean, I trained here in the Valley for a while before. Wow. And so this guy, Rick Drazen, I hired him as my coach and I trained with him and then,
That's so cool. Do you think it has anything to do with costumes? Like for instance, with the vampire costume, you had like that kind of veil over you in a sense. And then with the wrestling costume.
Yep. I think
not with the Tony Robbins part, but.
No, but I think costumes really, really help. Like for example, when I used to go on auditions for roles in movies or TV, if I dressed the part, I would get it. Because I felt it. And if I didn't, because I was a little too shy, or Kevin used to tell me all the time, just dress the part. And I would be too embarrassed and shy. And then you just didn't feel it. That helps so much when you get into that wardrobe and you embody it.
Yes.
So whatever you want to feel, if you're going out for a job for this executive position and you show up in jeans and a sweater,
yes,
you're not going to feel it.
Right.
So wherever you're going, you need to dress the part and really knock it out of the park. You're going to have an entire new confidence when you go in to whatever audition or meeting or, you know, job search you're going to go for.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. It definitely helps your energy.
Yeah.
Your confidence.
Wearing my suspenders right now makes me feel fun.
Like a farmer.
Like a little farmer girl. but interesting. I wanted to chat today. We were hoping to get to this on the show this week. Again, thank you for joining us on Conversations with Maria Menounos, the podcast edition. We hope that you love the show here so much that you'll want to join us on SiriusXM every day on channel 109 at 1 p.m. Eastern time. We hope that you'll rate, comment, subscribe to our podcast. Tell a friend. We're trying to grow this. And so anything you can do would be helpful. If you want to join our newsletter with life-changing tips and tricks, lots of really great giveaways, you can go to mariamenounos.com and sign up. If you want any past ones, they're actually on the website, right, Ashley? Mm-hmm.
Yes, they are.
Okay. Now that we got all that business out of the way, I did want to talk on the show this week and I forgot to it. About perfection. So the woman who wrote my women's health article that was in the January-February issue of Women's Health, her name's Lori Majewski. She sent me this book, and it's Anna Quinlan's book, and it's called Being Perfect. And I feel like a lot of women suffer from this desire for perfection. And then it's really, we kind of disguise it as anxiety. Oh my God, I have so much anxiety. And it's like, really, we're just trying to be perfect at everything, right? That's kind of the code word. Tony's always said at his seminars, he's like, anybody who says they're stressed should really be saying I'm fearful, because really it's the code word for fear. But no one wants to say I'm fearful. So you say I'm stressed, right? Think about whenever you're fearful, whenever you're stressed, you're really fearful. Something's not going to work out.
Absolutely.
Right. So I kind of think that when all of us are like, I have so much anxiety, it's really, we're trying to be perfect at everything and we're suffering. Mm-hmm. And so I read this book and I've marked so many pages in it that I wanted to share with you guys. I'm going to start with page 26. So this part that I loved, it said, when the president of Duke University commissioned a study on the status of women at the school, the results released in 2003 were astonishing. Female undergraduates talked of a culture at the college of effortless perfection in which they were expected to be attractive, well-dressed, in great shape, and academically able. Sounds true, right?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that what we're all expecting? It's not just these undergrads at Duke. We're all expected to be perfectly dressed, perfectly coiffed, perfectly groomed, perfectly everything. Perfect moms, perfect friends, perfect employees, perfect colleagues. And she says, I was mesmerized by that phrase, effortless perfection, because obviously it's an oxymoron. Even the illusion of perfection requires an amount of work, an enormous amount of work, right? I can tell you that by the end of the day of trying to be perfect, I was always exhausted, as if I'd done the whole thing at a fast clip in running shoes.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, it resonates.
She was describing me to a T.
I think all of us, and it's funny, where I guess we're not alone.
I'm like, I don't even have anything to say about this, because clearly this is me. I'm not going to be giving anyone any advice in this realm.
No, it's true. When I speak at the various speaking engagements that I've had, that's one of the things I just see women's shoulders go down so quickly and their eyes well up and they sigh, because I feel like even just by talking about it, I'm helping to release them of the need to be perfect and the need to be everything to everyone and nothing to themselves.
Right.
And I know I also talk about how I used to be the girl that would have flowers at your door the second anything happened. And now you have to be okay with the fact that I might get them there a couple months late, but I'm going to get them to you. But it has to be okay for me and it has to be okay for you, because I'm not going to be ruled every day by a to-do list and have all this anxiety because I didn't get you your flowers the day your new baby was born. I love you. You know I love you. You know I'm happy for you. I'm not going to be sick trying to take on the stress of being perfect and having everything there right at the right time. And that's like, those are some of the adjustments that I've made. Another thing I liked here, perfection irritates as well as it attracts.
Wow.
Nothing more annoying than someone who's trying to be perfect, right? It's like the perfect mother, the toughest of the all ideals to imagine, makes other women feel like failures simply by showing up and showing off.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
It's deep stuff. So the next thing that I marked that I loved is, perfection is static, even boring. Imitations are redundant. Your true unvarnished self is what is wanted. But we're so afraid to let that out because we're so afraid that we will not be wanted if we are just who we are.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Expectations and fears that you've acquired as a carapace, oh gosh, I don't even know what that means, along the way, you will be able to teach them by example not to be terrorized by the narrow and parsimonious expectations of the world, a world that often likes to color within the lines when a spray of paint, a scribble of a crayon, would be much more satisfying. I was always someone who perfectly drew inside the lines, by the way.
Yeah.
Pursuing perfection makes you unforgiving of the faults of others.
Oh, that's a big one.
That is a big one.
Okay, yep.
As Carl Jung once said, if people can be educated to see the lowly side of their own natures, it may be hoped that they will also learn to understand and love their fellow men better. A little less hypocrisy and a little more tolerance towards oneself mm-hmm. can only have good results in the respect for our neighbor. For we are all too prone to transfer to our fellows the injustice and violence we inflict upon our own natures.
100%. Well, they say whatever you're saying to other people, like if you and I had an argument and you were saying things to me that you felt whatever, and they weren't maybe positive, those are the things they say that you actually speak to yourself like.
Yeah.
So like, think about the next time someone says something to you, they're actually, that's how they talk to themselves. If anything, feel empathy for them.
Yeah.
That's their inner dialogue.
So if you are a self-proclaimed perfectionist and you are trying to be perfect at everything and you know you can't be, it's absolutely impossible, okay, you are having a really miserable experience and you're not being true to yourself. You're being so unforgiving of yourself. So then why would you be forgiving of others?
Absolutely. It's like you can't love others unless you love yourself. It's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And I thought that was really, really powerful. And then the last bit that I loved, it is a quest that causes us to doubt and denigrate ourselves, our true selves, our quirks, and our foibles, and great heroic leaps into the unknown. Much of what we are at 5 or 6 is what we wind up wishing we could be at 50 or 60.
Wow. I was just saying that to Ashley yesterday.
Yeah, you were.
What?
That I wish I could be more like I was as a child, when you have less fear, when you're less worried about what people are saying and thinking about you, and more so just kind of having that feeling of hope. Like, I know that I'm never going to be perfect no matter how hard I try. Mm-hmm. But as a kid, you think you can do anything and be anything. And I kind of wish I could steal a little bit from, you know, 6-year-old Christy.
What was 6-year-old Christy like?
She definitely did not take no for an answer. And really, like, I literally thought I was going to be the first female president.
Me too.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And that, you know, and a lawyer and a news anchor. And I wanted to just live up to all the expectations that I had put on myself, mm-hmm. I think, even at that age. But it didn't weigh on me then. Does that make sense? Like, I wanted to please my family and be my best me, but I wasn't worried about failing at it.
Yeah. Well, because you also didn't know how hard it really was going to be, right? Because you're not thinking of all the intricacies right. that you start to gather as you get older, mm-hmm. right? As you get older, you start to see a lot of negativity, and then you have people who are going to be negative and be like, that's not possible. You can't do that. Yeah. And then you start to believe all these negative forces, which is why it's so important to have really good people around you and quality relationships, because that's what's going to lift you and help you. But when you're young, it's like kind of unbridled. Like, you're just, I'm going to go do this. Okay.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So what's stopping you now?
Fear. Fear. Yeah. And I've never experienced that. It's kind of crept up on me in the last few years. I think as I got older and started to stress about, oh, I'm not at where I want to be in my career, I started to question it for the first time. You know, when I was younger, never did I ever not think that mm-hmm. I wasn't going to be Maria Menounos someday. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And as that started to kind of set in, I questioned myself. I questioned the future. And that is scary. It's terrifying. Really?
Well, look where you are now, though. You're like the
you're
best
on the
job.
Air with me.
You literally have the best job ever. Like, now you're so, like, in a sense, if you find a way to take a second and, like Marie says, like, just be in a state attitude of gratitude, you'll realize you're actually really, really, really in an amazing spot, both as, you know, professionally and I think just internally.
Absolutely.
I think both. Yeah. I think if you stop and think about it for a second, you'll be like, wait, is this real? You know, because that's how amazing it is from an outside perspective.
And I think having been so scared lately, I can see that I can get strength and bravery from you, Maria, and you, Ashley, when we're here during the day and Ashley's telling me, no, you can do it. Like, it's okay to get it from other people, too. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. But I think, you know, it's I lost my train of thought, actually. I'm going to shut up now. I lost my train of thought for what I was going to tell you, because you shifted and then I forgot where we were at. But I do feel like it's hard as you get older. Like, oh, this is what I was going to ask. When you were not in a state of fear, were things happening that you wanted to happen? Were you growing and getting there little
yes.
bit by little bit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so slowly. So when you stop focusing, like I said this week on the show, when you stop focusing on the have-nots and focus on the haves, that's when you realize that's when you're going to feel really, truly happy, right? Like Ashley said, you have this great job and you're on air and you're around people that are lifting you, probably maybe for the first time. I don't know.
Yes, absolutely for the first time.
And so this is exactly where you need to be and where you're supposed to be, because maybe God loves you enough to not let you be in those bad environments that were only going to continue to beat you down, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of what I think for myself. I'd had enough of that.
Yeah, exactly.
And so if you stay super in this moment and grateful for what you have, more of what you want will come. So
that's a good point.
I'm ready. I'm ready now.
I love that. What did you want to be when you were really young? Do you remember the first thing?
I wanted to be a teacher. That was the first thing, I think. I remember telling my cousin when I was in Connecticut. And then I wanted to be a marine biologist. My mom made fun of me because she knew I just wanted to play with the dolphins and stuff. And she was right.
That's so cute.
I think there was a moment I wanted to be a lawyer, too.
Really?
Yeah, because I loved defending and all of that.
Yeah.
And then I wanted to be a hockey player.
Really? Well, that's the boy in you. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's a little boy in you. That's
so
cute.
So many different things. But back to the perfection talk. My quest for perfection has been exhausting. And that's why I'm trying to undo so many of these things where I'm like, you know what? My friend, I love you. My flowers are just showing up 4 months later. I'm so sorry. I love you. I don't even have to say I'm sorry. It's just, by the way, they actually get so much more excited when they end up showing up because they're like, oh my God.
This is so interesting that your version of, I think we all have different versions of like being a perfectionist. Seems like yours is the pressure you put on yourself is to please others or to give to others. Like you mentioned a couple times, like being the good friend, sending the flowers,
sending the flowers,
the good friend. Yeah. But
it's everything. Being perfect at everything.
Yeah, no, totally. But you've always felt that responsibility to take care of everybody you love.
It's important for me for people to know that I care and that I'm there and that, and that I'm trying and that I'm working hard and that I'm everything. And it's so overwhelming for women, you know.
Yeah.
You know, men are not expected to do even a quarter of what we do. No one's asking a man, how do you balance it all? Who's asking a man
I don't think I've ever heard that in my life.
Right? But guess what? We are asked that every day. By the way, it's always been my number one question to women. Like, I'll sit with a Heidi Klum, like, how do you do it all?
Wow.
How do you do it all? Right? Because I want to know the secret sauce because everybody thinks we're supposed to be doing it all. And guess what? It's such a myth. This is all a myth. You can't do it all and have it all. There are going to be areas you're not going to be as strong in. And you have to kind of just be okay with that. You know, you're not going to remember. Like, I pride myself on the fact that I remembered everyone's birthdays. By the way, my surgery day last year. So Stephen Lemieux works for us over at AfterBuzz. We share a birthday. I come out of surgery. I finally am in a room. It's like really kind of my first big memories are like getting into a room. I can't see straight. I'm having triple vision. And now they're bringing in eye patches and I have to keep my eyes closed. And I'll never forget, Kevin, don't forget it's Steven's birthday.
Oh, that's so cute.
Did he give a shit? I told him this. He had no reaction. He didn't care. He did not even process or understand how massive that moment was that like I'm just out of brain surgery and I'm remembering one of my employees' birthdays. And I was like,
it's beautiful.
I told Kevin, I'm like, see? This is like evidence. Like, I'm not supposed to be perfect. No one's expecting that of me. And really, you didn't give a shit anyway.
Yeah.
Steven, if you're listening, yes, I find that a little sad.
Does he know the story?
Yes, I told him. Whoa. And I was just like, just a boy. That's how boys are.
Yeah.
But
as Kevin calls him, Stephen Lemieux, a boy in his 20s.
Yeah. But the point is people aren't really expecting the things that we think they're expecting.
Yeah.
And we're placing so much unnecessary pressure on ourselves and we're so stressed and then everyone's popping pills and we're like, crazy stress bombs that nobody wants to be around and our husbands want to hide from us. Yes, Kevin always asked whatever house we were buying, where could he hide from me? I'm serious. I'm being honest. I was not fun sometimes because I was so stressed and anxiety. Now, what is that? That's fear and that's trying to be perfect at everything. So I leave you all with those thoughts. The book, again, is called Being Perfect. It's by Anna Quindlen. And I hope you guys take a look at it because it's a very short book, but it's very poignant. In the meantime, we have a really great show for you guys today. Rabbi Steve Leder wrote an amazing book called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. He's going to be talking about why suffering's an invitation to change your life and how to manifest those changes by tapping into your inner resources and reaching out to others. We also have Chelsea Hill, who is on the show this week. She's a paraplegic dancer, and she's going to be sharing her inspiring story of overcoming obstacles, how she rose above the news that she'd never walk again. This is a girl who talked about making a choice to get in a car after a party with someone who'd been drinking. They got into a big car crash, hit a tree, and she's been paraplegic ever since. And she has a really great story to share, a very inspiring story. If you're listening to this and you know someone young that is in high school, this is a really great story to share with them, because it really can happen to anybody. She's a beautiful girl who whose life was changed forever from that one choice and that one decision. And so I'm excited for you guys to listen to these interviews. We're going to start up with Rabbi Steve Leader. Guys, my next guest is an author and rabbi who was named by Newsweek magazine as one of the 10 most influential rabbis in America. He's here now to talk to us about his new book, More Beautiful Than Before. Please welcome Rabbi Steve Leader. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being here. Yeah. So tell me why you wanted to write this book.
I wrote this book because I've been a rabbi for 30 years, and being a rabbi means being on the inside of many people's lives and seeing suffering really up close. You know, it's my phone that rings when people's lives and bodies, you know, and careers and reputations fall apart. So for 27 years, I spent time counseling people on what I call the couch of tears in my office. And then I experienced for the first time in my life extreme physical pain followed by emotional pain. And I realized that while I had done my best for 27 years to help people who were suffering, I actually knew nothing about suffering. And it wasn't until I suffered myself that I realized what that world of pain is about, the fear and anxiety and depression attended to it, and the opportunity that pain presents to really change your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to share that message. You know, when you intro'd the book, you said the book is called More Beautiful Than Before, which is half right. It's called More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Because suffering is an invitation. It's an invitation to change your life.
Mm-hmm. I 100% agree with that. Having gone through what we've gone through in this last year, I said the same thing. I said this tumor was the greatest gift.
Yes.
And I knew it right off the bat, because I knew, I didn't call it an invitation to change my life, but I knew it was here to help me change my life. It was, you know, it was sent to me for a reason. But I do also believe that what happened to you was profound, because you are now able to probably help people in such a bigger way than you were before. Even you were a rabbi then, you're a rabbi now, but when you go through that pain and see all of the different stages of it and how it can be a blessing and a gift later, and if you see it that way, I think you get through the journey much quicker, right?
I don't know about getting through it quicker, because I think the lessons of pain ebb and flow and ebb and flow. I don't think it's a linear process. But I can say that I help people in a way that is much more authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And and at a deeper level, and in a way in which they know I really do understand.
Yeah.
And they feel heard. And by the way, I think it has to be said that I'm not trying, and I don't think you are either, to sort of glorify suffering as sort of a step on the path of enlightenment. None of this is worth it. Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't choose this.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have chosen a brain tumor. But, you know, as I say in the book, everyone walks through hell sooner or later. To be human is to suffer. Or as the great sage Bob Marley put it, when the rain falls, it don't fall on one man's house, mm-hmm. right? We all suffer. So I say in the book, everyone walks through hell. But the point is not to come out empty-handed. Make something of that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Change your life for the better as a result of that experience, fully recognizing we wish it never would have happened.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's hard especially when pain is involved. But how do you guide someone through these tough times now, having gone through the pain yourself? How do you guide them differently than you were before?
Well, the first thing that I do when I'm, you know, reaching out or being reached out to by someone in pain is I have a conversation with them about other things they've been through in their life. Other than this, what's the most painful thing you've ever gotten through in your life? And they can always answer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next question is, well, how did you do that? How did you get through that? And then we take a look at what coping mechanisms helped them get through that. And I remind them, you know, all of that ability and all that strength, or those particular people that you reached out to, or your faith, they're still there. You know, this brain tumor didn't rob you of the love in your family. It didn't rob you of your intelligence. It didn't rob you of your internal resources, and you need to summon those resources. The first chapter in the book is called When You Must, You Can.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really true. When you must, you can. And having that faith in yourself is extremely important. The second thing, there's another piece in the book called The Prisoner Cannot Free Himself. Mm-hmm. The prisoner cannot free himself. You have to reach out.
Right.
You have to be willing to reach out for help.
Mm-hmm.
Your friend has to be, you know, willing to come to you. You know, you, Maria, to your friends to say, or your family, you know, I'm scared. I'm afraid.
Yeah.
I'm worried. I need your help. And you will be amazed because people will reach out and lift you from your suffering. Mm-hmm. They will.
You just, ask for the help. So many people just bottle it all up. And
yeah.
Particularly high-achieving people who are used to, you know, doing it all on their own and who think of strength in terms of independence.
Right.
Real strength is the willingness and the ability to say, I need you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Help me. That's a strong person.
Yeah.
That's interesting. You know, for me, when I went through this, I didn't tell anybody because I couldn't tell my parents because my mom was dealing with stage 4 brain cancer and she wasn't doing well. And so we had to keep it so, so quiet. And the weekend before surgery is when I started to tell a few people in the inner circle because my therapist was like, Marie, you have to tell people. That's it's not real until you start telling people. And up until then, I hadn't cried. I wasn't scared. There was a moment where certain doctors scared me and I was nervous and I had to make a decision. So that was like a fearful moment. But other than that, I was like, it's been great. Whatever it is at this point. But only time I cried is when I actually reached out and told friends. Mm-hmm. That was when I cried. It was like this awkward moment of me having to be vulnerable.
Right. Yes.
Even as I'm just saying, it was the first time I actually really understood what it was. It was me being vulnerable with
That's
them
right.
and having to say, I need you, even if it's just yes. emotionally.
And what was the end result of exposing
God.
That vulnerability?
It was unbelievable.
Their right. reaction.
It was the most unbelievable experience because I got to hear the things that most people never get to hear
right.
because most people only say those things at funerals.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so I got the opportunity to hear what I meant to people and what they thought of me and how they felt about me in those moments. It was the most emotional experience and it was the most beautiful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, being vulnerable, like you said, for someone who's type A and really like independent. And I mean, I was walking at 8 months old,
yeah.
like, and I wanted yeah. to walk earlier, but yeah. you know, my yeah. little crooked legs couldn't hold me up. So yeah, that was really, really big for me. And I think that's a big point for people to hear.
Pain and suffering reveal this paradox, which is that, you know, when broken, you are simultaneously in some way more whole, that there's a wholeness that comes from brokenness that can't be achieved any other way. And again, you know, is it worth it? Well, we don't get to choose that.
Yeah.
You know, a friend of mine who had 3 different cancers when he was dying of the 3rd cancer, he looked up at me from his hospital bed and he said, you know, Steve, this much character I don't need. You know,
wow.
Right?
Right.
It's like,
I know.
Let's not pretend it's worth it, but but neither is it worthless.
Yeah. Well, for me, I feel like it was worth it, and I would never change it for a million years.
Now.
In a million years.
Yes.
But I do want to ask you, in the book when I was reading, you talked about prayer and not asking for cures, asking for healing. I want you to explain that to people, because I'm in the process of asking for a miracle for my mom, because I know it's possible. I know that there are so many spontaneous remissions that have occurred in this world for people. And I feel like that this happened for a reason for my family to come together, for roles to shift. I've done a lot of like reflecting on it. And so I'm like, okay, God, we got the message. I hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, now can we get a miracle? Sure. Like, can we please heal her, because she's young and I have the two most unbelievable parents in the world. I'm like, please, please, please. All they've done is given to people. Can you give me this miracle? And so that's what I'm praying for. But then when you say pray for healing, then I get confused.
Yes. Well, let me ask this. What would it say about God if the end result is not what you prayed for? Then we're talking about a God that's heartless, unfeeling, capricious, uncaring. So I would just ask you to consider that what you might be doing and is hoping for a miracle rather than praying for a miracle.
Yeah.
They're not the same thing. Because praying and wishing are not the same thing. You may be wishing for a miracle and hoping for a miracle, which you should be, and which helps you and helps your mother. But praying for a miracle implies that God is a granter of wishes. And if God was a granter of wishes, all of our lives in the world would be very, very different.
Yeah.
So when I pray, I'm praying not to change God or manipulate God. I'm praying to change myself, my own attitude. The way when you were first diagnosed, you just said to me, you know, I said, I've had it. This is you talking. I'm not going to get it exactly right. But you said, look, whatever it is, it is. I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
No matter what. That's praying. That's a healing kind of prayer. That's a prayer that says, you know, give me the strength to stand up in this storm, come what may. That's a prayer. That's not a wish to be granted, right? So when I pray, I'm really praying to change myself, not God. It's an internal conversation. You know, there's a 17th century rabbi who explained it this way. If you knew nothing about the physics of the world and you saw a fisherman pulling his boat to the shore with a rope, if you knew nothing about physics, you might think he was pulling the shore to the boat, right? Not the boat to the shore. That's the mistake people make about prayer, in my view. They think of prayer as kind of pulling God down into their lives and themselves and their situation. When in fact, what prayer is, for me at least at its best, is a pulling of ourselves up to God.
Oh, that really makes sense.
That's interesting.
Wow.
And that's an understanding of prayer that works in a world where bad things do happen to people who don't deserve it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I remember a friend of ours on Sirius, her girlfriend's dad was sick, and he had he was something with his heart, I can't remember now. Anyway, he would go into these really dangerous parts of the world and help very, very ill kids, and I mean, give so much. And I remember praying and being like, God, please help him. Like, this is somebody who's given. Don't take him. Like, you have to. And he did. He made it. He's okay. And he wasn't supposed to be okay.
But the prayer, that kind of prayer, Maria, does imply that God chooses who to save, who not to save, who lives, who dies. And if that's the case, how do we explain that church shooting yesterday?
Yeah.
How do we explain the shooting in Vegas?
I don't know.
Well, you can't blame anyone but God if you believe in a God that intervenes in life that way.
But I feel like God has like a plan for us, right? So if I'm asking for a miracle for my mom and she doesn't get it, I'm not going to be mad at God. I'm going to say, okay, why did this happen? What was the reason that I needed to go through this? What was the reason it wasn't granted? This miracle wasn't granted.
Right. So your view would be God did answer. God said no.
God said
for God's
no
own
for a reason.
Exactly.
So it's not like I have this grudge or anything like that. It's like, okay, well, this wasn't meant to be, and there's probably a bigger lesson here.
So this is much closer to what I mean when I talk about prayer. This, by the way, is the oldest of stories. This is God's answer to Job. Job loses everything. And by the way, by the book's own admission, the very first sentence says Job was a blameless man. He did nothing wrong. And his life is destroyed, right? And this is a myth. Remember, a myth isn't a lie. A myth is a way of describing reality,
mm-hmm.
right? A myth is a truth, not a fact. Mm-hmm. So what is the truth of this myth of this book called Job? That innocent people suffer. And when Job loses his family, loses his health, loses his business, he goes before God, and what's God's answer? God does answer, which is an amazing thing in and of itself in that book. In my view, Job's the most important book in the Bible. And God says to Job, are you big? I am. Do you keep the sea within its shores? Do you make the sun rise and the moon set? I do. I make it rain where no man lives. And what God is saying there is that there are things you will never understand because you're only human. You can only know so much and you can only do so much. Mm-hmm. You know, in the Bible, when God says, I am God, it also means, and you are not. You are not God. Only God is God. And this, Maria, is something I think you and I both feel very deeply, and it's helpful that our understanding is limited. And there are forces at work in the cosmos beyond any human being's comprehension. You know, the Canadian philosopher Marsha McLuhan said, I don't know who discovered water, but it wasn't the fish. Right? We're so immersed in our own reality, we have no perspective on it.
Yeah.
When does a fish discover water? Think about it.
Yeah.
When it's caught.
Yeah.
When it's out of the water, flailing on the right. banks, gasping for air. When did you discover good health, Maria?
When I didn't have it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When do you discover the true depths of your love for your parent?
When they're not there.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right? So we are not fully aware of our own existence. And pain is one of those things that jerks us out of the water of our own existence and teaches us lessons that simply can't be learned any other way.
Yeah.
One of them, which has to do with this thing we're discussing about God and Job, is humility. You know, people ask me how I've changed since, you know, I went through my own spinal surgery and the opioid addiction and all these things that I talk about in the book. And I tell people, well, I wasn't a bad guy before, but I'm a nicer person.
Mm. More empathetic?
Much more.
Yeah.
And nicer to the people around me, the people I work for, more appreciative. There's a conversation about sages that I recount in the book where one sage says, why does God in the Bible say, I put words upon your heart? Why did God, who's so powerful, choose to put words upon our hearts rather than just put them into our hearts? And the answer the other sage gives is, because it's not until our hearts are broken that the words can enter.
Right.
It's amazing. Mm. The book is out officially today, right?
Today's the launch day.
I'm
going
to go get one.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
So exciting.
It is.
And it's a beautiful book. It's a quick read and a beautiful book. We were just talking about whatever you believe will be. And I think that, you know, you can have a really positive mindset like we've talked about, but you have to be also cautiously kind of optimistic and be prepared for whatever is going to come, and knowing that whatever is going to come is what's supposed to be. That's what I feel.
And that you have the capacity to embrace whatever comes.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
Yeah.
To walk through hell is to know I have the ability and the wisdom and the strength and the love in my friendships and families to embrace whatever reality comes my way.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like when I was reading in your book, there was something, and I hope I say this right, but something about if you have faith, then how can you be fearful, right? So like right now we're having like all these burglaries in the neighborhood and and I'm like all hyped up and I'm watching everyone and I'm scaring them out of the neighborhood and, you know, we're all watching and everything. And I'm waking up with anxiety and I'm scared because first of all, I'm like, well, we have nothing for them to steal. Right. There's literally no artwork, no joy. There's nothing here. So what am I really afraid of? Like, okay, I'm afraid of maybe being hurt myself. But I'm like, if I, and I know, and I see it, Rabbi, I see every single day God sends me messages. Mm-hmm. God sends me people exactly when I need them. So when I opened your book this morning to refresh, I saw that message about fear and faith. And I'm like, wait, why am I being so scared when I 100% know that I'm protected, that I'm guided, and that I know even if this was to happen, it was for a reason.
Yes.
So then it like released some pain this morning for me. Sorry, I don't know why I'm getting so emotional about it, but
everyone who reads this book ends up crying. I don't know what this
Well,
I think what you're talking about is what I call in the book catastrophizing.
Yeah.
Right? It's a very human thing. First of all, there's a biological reason for it. The reason all of us are here, the reason our DNA survived is because we are the descendants of people who millions of years ago lived as if there was a tiger behind every tree.
Yeah, I remember reading that. I am the tiger, and I'm ready.
That's why our DNA survived.
But this is also why we're getting sick, because we're all so fight or flight all day long.
That's right, and it no longer squares with reality.
Yeah.
Right? So our emotional state is in tune with an ancient biological state. I call it catastrophizing the future. Look, we all like to step to the edge of a cliff and look down and imagine, oh my God, if I fell off, there I am tumbling down and splattering on the rocks below. We all create these nightmares in our minds. And I don't have any illusions about human nature. But if when you're going through a difficult situation, you can catastrophize the future even 10% less. Just 10%. That's all I'm asking for.
Yeah. Right?
Let's take your situation in the neighborhood here. It's where I'm saying, Maria, look, I don't expect you to never think about it or worry, but if you could catastrophize 10% less, if 10% of the time when your mind goes to you're going to be invaded and burglarized, switch it to a more positive message, which is I'm safe and I can take care of myself. Mm-hmm. Just 10% is all I'm asking for.
Right.
It will dramatically.
I feel like I've done that without even realizing it recently. Yeah.
Shifting?
I feel like I've done that because similar thing being at home alone.
Yeah.
And I feel like I've like got myself worked up and then I sort of switch my thoughts.
And I'm not asking for a complete change in human nature.
Right.
But just a little bit makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
A huge difference. Because the truth is, the worst almost never happens.
Yeah.
And we waste so much emotional, physical and psychic and spiritual energy catastrophizing.
Yes. It's exhausting. Yeah, it's exhausting. But I think when I was even having, you know, breakthroughs this morning thinking about it, I'm like, but I grew up in a violent home where I never felt safe. And so that's just carried on.
But knowing that and saying, this is my violent childhood talking.
Mm-hmm.
This is not my neighborhood talking.
Yeah.
Even knowing that is a way of backing yourself up from the ledge. I grew up with a tyrannical father, which I imagine is similar to what you faced in some ways. And I have to every day wrestle with that demon. And thank goodness for the negative example of how not to behave as a husband, as a father.
Yeah. Mm. Well, then also it gives you a whole other skill set that I know has made me successful in other ways, right? Like when you are constantly in fear, you can see things faster than other people. You can make connections much faster than other people. So even in business, I know 20 steps ahead before someone's going to hurt me. I'm like, they're about to do this, 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 and this. and it's going to end up in this. And they're like, how do you know that? And I'm like, I don't know.
It's the upside of the downside.
There's the upside of the downside. Exactly.
That's right. You know, I'm an enormously ambitious person because the only thing that mattered to my father, who was a blue-collar guy and owned a junkyard, was how hard I worked at the junkyard.
Mm-hmm.
At 5 years old, I was scrubbing floors and toilets with him behind me saying, I want to see nothing but asses and elbows. At five.
Wow.
Now, that damaged me in some ways, but it also made me very successful.
Right.
I'm not smarter than other rabbis. I just work really, really hard. Mm-hmm. Now, that's also what broke my back and caused the surgery. And, you know, then I end up on opioids and depressed. And so there are upsides and downsides.
Yeah.
And the question is really not, do we suffer? The question is, can we make something beautiful of that suffering?
Yes.
Don't come out of hell empty-handed.
Yeah, it's like, how do we help people? I was having a conversation with someone this weekend who has gone through similar experiences in this business like I have, and we were sharing that over text, and I was like, we have the power to help people. We have voices. We have our creativity. We have, you know.
Look what you're doing. Look at the platform you've created to talk to people who are suffering. Yeah. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it, you know, there's this great little story about Yitzhak Perlman, the violinist in the book, who walked, you know, has had polio since he was a child. And he walked out onto the stage one night to play a concerto, and one of the strings on his violin broke. And he played the entire concerto, redoing the fingering in his mind as he went along. And at the end, the audience went absolutely crazy, crazy. And he quieted them down, and he looked at them and said, it's my job to make music with what remains.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's more beautiful than before, right?
Yeah, yeah. That is.
Well, that's what's inspiring, like when you watch people defy the odds and, you know, no matter what their ailment or impairment is or disability, when they go above and beyond, they serve as inspiration. And so I remember asking my mom, I do this event at the Children's Hospital every year. And I remember coming home crying and being like, why these little kids, kids who have done nothing, blameless. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, we would have no compassion and we would have no empathy if we weren't shown this.
You know, I have to say, I would try to move off of the why question to what? Not
what?
Why do these children suffer? Because that's an unanswerable question. We don't know the answer to that question. The quicker we can move when it comes to suffering from the why to the what question, I think the better it is for everyone.
Like what can be learned?
What am I going to do about the fact that innocent children suffer in an oncology ward?
Right.
What am I going to use my resources for, my time, my money, my influence for, given that this happens?
Yeah.
Moving, why is sort of a cul-de-sac, and you just go around and around and around and around. Why did you have a brain tumor?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We could go around in that cul-de-sac for the rest of our lives. The question is, can you move from why to what?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
What am I going to do about this? How is it going to change my life?
Yep.
That's a much more, I think, productive and healing way to approach these painful situations.
Yeah,
you know,
that.
It also works on the other side of pain. And what I mean by that is there are lots of books about pain, but one of the things in More Beautiful Than Before that I didn't see out there is there's a lot of material in it for when we are the cause of pain, not the victim.
Right.
When we're the betrayer, not the betrayed.
Mm-hmm.
What then? How do we deal with that pain and that guilt and that shame in a way that transforms our lives for the better? That's a major, major challenge for people.
That's a tough one. I remember I went through a lot of guilt breaking up with an engagement, and I lived with guilt for years over it, for breaking his heart and everything, and it was horrible. It was a very hard thing to get through because you put so much blame on yourself, and that's amazing that you have that in the book.
And how do you address that?
Yeah.
And then how do you live with the guilt or shame keeping it in its proper role and context without letting it overwhelm you, but nevertheless letting it guide you through the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing. Rabbi Steve Leder, thank you so much for your knowledge and wisdom and for sharing this book with us. I hope that interview was helpful to you. Up next, Chelsea Hill. Enjoy. We are back, guys, and joining me now is a dancer, speaker, entrepreneur who founded the Roulettes, one of the biggest wheelchair dance teams in the world after being paralyzed at the age of 17. Please welcome the gorgeous Chelsea Hill.
Hi, guys. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. I was just saying to you, I'm like, she's like glowing, right?
Totally. Couldn't agree more. And it's not a highlight. Or maybe it is. Maybe it's both.
No, I think it's like inner glow popping out, right?
Thank you.
Are you happy?
I am.
You seem happy.
And it's a beautiful day out. I love the warmth.
I know. It really is nice.
It's a great day.
So tell us your story. Right. For somebody who doesn't know you, it's important to kind of go from where everything started for you and where it's gone, because you've done so much advocacy work and public speaking and you have a really inspiring story. So let's start. Who is Chelsea Hill?
So I was born and raised in Monterey, California. I started dancing at the age of 3. I started competing nationally and regionally when I was 5 years old, and I grew a very strong passion for dance at a young age.
What kind of dance?
I did jazz, hip hop, funk, palm. I did a little bit of ballet, and I did some gymnastics. So I did a little bit of everything, but my favorite was always hip hop and jazz. Mm-hmm. Loved it. And so I grew up dancing. I did other sports and stuff, but I always would stay with dancing, and I'd always be like, all right, sorry, softball team, I'm going to go to dance practice. Yeah. Can't do that game because I have dance practice. And so I love dancing. I knew that was something that I could make my parents proud with. I always brought home a trophy. I always won first place. And it's something that I wanted to take on as a career. I wanted mm-hmm. to move to LA and be a professional backup dancer. And that was my goal. That was something that I wanted to do. And I went into high school and made the varsity dance team. And my senior year, my entire life changed.
Tell us about that.
It was a night where there was a basketball game, and it was the one basketball game that we weren't performing at. So I was getting ready at my house, and one of my best friends was there with me, and my boyfriend and I at the time had broken up the night before. And so I was like, I'm going to go out, and I'm going to have a good time. And I remember telling my best friend, I was like, I'm not going to drink, though, because in case he calls, maybe I can just go pick him up, and we'll make up and be back together. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of people can maybe relate to that. But I went to a party, wasn't drinking, and then found out that he was at another party. And so I went, and he ended up not talking to me, long story short. And so I started playing beer pong, and it got to be super late. And I remember I had work the next morning, and I was like, I gotta go home. Like, I'll just walk home. And I remember someone saying, hey, I'm leaving. Does anyone need a ride? And me drinking and, you know, thinking at the age of 17, like, sure, yeah, I'll get a ride home. And so 7 of us piled into a 5-seater car. I didn't realize that the driver had been drinking. I saw him having a cup, but I didn't know that, you know, if there was like, if he had had 10 beers or 10 shots or what. And me being, you know, a high school student, not realizing the dangers of what drinking and driving can do, I didn't say anything. And we dropped off 2 people, and I slid into the middle seat, and we were just listening to music, driving in a Skyline Forest, which is like a forest. There's just a really narrow street and no lights. And I remember we were listening to music and having a good time, and all of a sudden I see this yellow flashing light, and it said like 25 miles an hour, slow down. And it was like he didn't even see the turn coming up, and he drove right over the curb. And I think he just tried to get off the curb, and he accidentally overcorrected, and we went down an embankment and hit a tree head on.
Wow.
So,
oh my gosh.
When he was driving, was he driving erratically? Do you remember before that?
Yeah, he was driving super fast, but he was one of my friends, and it was one of those situations where I feel like he wouldn't have put us in danger, and I felt like I could trust him. Yeah. And so I didn't.
Well,
see
all
anything.
Of your you are all impaired at that point.
Yes.
So like at that point,
right?
You're not. I was just trying to see like how or where were you a little nervous in the car before, and just kind of being like, oh, it'll be fine.
You know, I had been drinking at the time, yeah. So I was just living life, loving it, listening to the music being blasted, yeah. Dancing in the car with my friends. And then all of a sudden, I remember that as soon as he turned, I fell onto my friend's lap. And as soon as I sat up, there was just a tree and I blacked out.
And then what happened when you woke up? What do you remember the first time you woke up?
The first time I woke up, like actually being able to see, I could only see out of one side of my on my left eye, but that's when I remembered being in the hospital. But I remember.
So you don't remember waking up at the scene?
No, but I was awake talking. And I remember,
scene.
Yeah.
Wow.
My ex-boyfriend was in the car with me. And so I ran out to get shotgun. And he was like, no, I get shotgun. You're sitting in the back. And that was the only thing he said to me that night.
Wow.
And so he woke up first screaming, I guess. And I was, my legs were underneath the driver's seat. And I was. The seatbelt was holding me up. And so I guess he came around to get to me. And this is all what he told me later. And he ended up trying to get me out of the car. And when I couldn't get out, he goes, push into your legs and I'll pull you up. And I remember that. I remember that feeling of feeling stuck. And it was because I was paralyzed. Wow. And I remember he was like, just push into your legs and I'll pull you out of the car because the car was out of tilt. And he, and I, as soon as he said that, he told me, I said, I can't. And he said, why? And I said, I can't feel my legs.
Ugh.
And
oh my gosh.
At that time, someone drove up and looked down and was like, don't touch her. And he just walked, the innocent bystander said that he like walked away with his hands up and wow. went up to the top of the mountain and was like crying until the cops came. So
that's so crazy.
So. How everyone else survived in the car?
Everyone survived, luckily.
Which
I'm
is
so happy.
An absolute miracle because yeah. usually it's the person in the passenger seat. Like my cousin was killed in a car crash.
Wow.
Similar. And he was in the passenger seat. And they actually said it was the blow from the seatbelt that
yeah.
hurt him.
And I'm very thankful that because of where I was sitting and because of the injury, that at least I didn't have a head injury, you know,
yeah.
because my head smacked the center console. My entire side of my face was like twice its size. All my organs inside of my stomach were twice the size they should have. My stomach swelled up till I looked like I was 6 months pregnant.
Wow.
And I remember like the doctor showing me my seatbelt scar that I still have to this day. And I was just like, oh my gosh. And I remember feeling like the, I felt like my stomach was like this big, like it was just
wow.
the size of a small apple.
Right.
And I remember feeling it and being like, okay, it's not. So why do I feel like I'm like cut in half? Like, and then I couldn't feel my legs. I couldn't. And my entire family was like, maybe it's the medicine, you know, for the first 2 weeks of my injury. I had no idea what was going on. I knew I was in a car accident, but
how long were you in the hospital for?
51 days.
51 days. And what were the final, what was the final diagnosis for you? And what?
You know, about 2 weeks, it was, I was in ICU. I was in pediatric ICU because I was still 17. And I knew I was in a car accident. I knew I had to go into back surgery. I had a 7.5 hour back surgery. They opened me from the top of my neck to my tailbone. Fused L1 to L5. They released a blood clot at T2, so I could have been a higher level injury. And then 2 weeks later, the doctor came in and he goes, so do you have any questions? And I was like, well, yeah, you know, why can't I feel my legs? And he goes, just so blunt, he goes, well, you have a spinal cord injury and you're never going to walk again.
Just like that?
Just like that. And my mom and dad were standing on both sides of the hospital bed.
Had they known before that?
They knew.
Yeah.
They knew the second they showed up at the hospital. And every time I even think about what my parents went through, I get the chills. Like getting that knock on the door and
yeah.
getting that phone call and having my parents drive an hour and a half not knowing if their child was going to die or
yeah.
what my severities and my injuries were, just knowing I was in a car accident, I was being airlifted, like – I can't imagine what that hour and a half felt like. And, you know, my dad was the first person to be at my bedside, and I was able to talk. And so he was like, I felt so relieved. And I said, I'm fine. I just can't feel my legs. And he said, he's like, my knees buckled and I almost hit the ground. And that's when he found out.
Yeah. I've had that happen to me twice. Once when we found out my cousin was killed, and then the other time when my mom was airlifted because of her brain tumor. And I know that pain, it's awful.
Yeah.
Because you're just in such shock and your whole body just can't even process that information.
And it's like you feel so like you want to help, but you don't know what to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And so they kept that information, which was a burden for them, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And when you found out, what did you think and how did you handle it?
You know, I honestly, I was in shock. I think like at the age of 17, wanting to dance and having to, like, I needed my body. I needed my legs. I was honestly in denial. I was like, there's no way you can go from walking one day to being an active, like, outgoing dancer to being strapped to a wheelchair. Yeah. Like, I didn't think that was, I couldn't even fathom the thought of going back to school, going back to my life and trying to recreate who I was. So honestly, those 51 days, they were hard. I had my moments. I woke up screaming and crying, and I had my like, why me moments. But also I was so in denial. I was like, I'm going to be that miracle. I'm going to be the miracle that walks.
The girl that walks.
The girl that walks, you know, and that gets up and walks. And when I got home, that's when reality hit. And I wasn't getting things back. And I had to figure out how to be me and find myself again and fall back in love with dance. And I just had to figure it out.
I want to know how you kind of pushed through and how you got past the kind of inevitable why me, and you know, having your life completely change at such a young age, like at the age where you're about to go make your dreams into reality.
Yeah. You know, by my bedside every single night, my father literally slept on this little couch. And I remember the conversation. I woke up one night because my Dilaudid machine malfunctioned and shut off. And so I was out. I was without pain meds for like 7 hours.
Ugh.
And I woke up screaming in so much pain. It was after my 7-hour back surgery. And I was just screaming to him, like, why me, Dad? Like, why did I have to be paralyzed? Like, I had so much going for myself. Like, what's going on? Like, what am I going to do? And, you know, I don't know what it feels like to be a father or a parent yet. But my dad, you know, told me, he was like, he said at that moment, he's like, I didn't know what to say. He's like, I was just grabbing at straws. And he was like, well, maybe it's you, because you're supposed to go and raise money to help someone find a wheelchair that fits them. And maybe you're supposed to go on to do bigger things than you never dreamed of. And I was just like, and I remember tearing up being like, I can make a difference in someone's life like that. And he goes, yeah, you can do anything.
Oh,
and I like still get to the chills to this day. Like, and my dad and my mom, like my mom brought me like food. I never ate hospital food ever. And she brought me breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Aww. Every single day. And you know, like I owe it to them. They are the people that gave me the strength to get through those 51 days and the last 7 years, because they never made me feel different. They never made me feel like I was a burden. They were just like, you want to do this? We're going to figure it out, you know? And I told my dad, I want to dance. And he goes, why don't you start a dance team? And I was like, I can do that. And he was like, you always dreamed of it. So I owe it to my friends and family, but my parents were the ones that saw me at my lowest points and really helped me figure out how to climb again.
And did they never made you feel, did they ever ask you about that night? I mean, did they ever bring that up again?
Yeah, I definitely remember some talks. We obviously had to have those talks, and I had to talk them out and go through that night and like, where did I go wrong? You know, what was I thinking? And we had a lot of talks, but also, you know, a month after I got home from the hospital, my dance team wanted to do my first wheelchair dance team and surprise my whole school. So my dad went and got wheelchairs all over Northern California and drove around with his big truck trying to find them. And, you know, we had a lot of conversations. My parents are divorced, and they've been divorced for so long, and you know, it really pulled us all together. And I was able to have those open conversations with them. And I've always been open with my parents with, you know, going to parties and going out and drinking and stuff. I always was so open, and it was, you know, we've always had that open relationship.
So you've done some public speaking, and I imagine to students.
Yeah.
What do you tell them? How do you guide them? It's so hard because when we are young, we all think we are invincible.
100%.
Yeah. And there's not one person that does not make a mistake or have an error in judgment. And I am of the belief that things happen for a reason. And I think that you are strong and that this was something that was maybe supposed to happen for you because you are supposed to be that light for other people. And I feel like you kind of have found that yourself, right?
Yeah. You know, I started speaking literally 2 weeks after I got home from the hospital. I spoke at an every 15 minutes program and
2 weeks.
I mean, look at you.
That's insane.
Well, yeah. I was literally in the hospital after my back surgery and I was like, can I Skype my school? I want them to know what happened to me. And I want them to know that they shouldn't make that mistake too. Like I was like trying to get my principal involved and literally my dad was calling everyone, but
you were already in mama bear protect mode. I want to help everybody else.
But like, I wanted people to know that like, I was just your average girl. I was just like everyone else. And because of that mistake and because of that choice that I made getting in the car, look where it left me. Right. And if it can happen to me, it can happen to everyone, anyone.
Yep.
So when you're speaking at schools, is that your main message? Is it about life choices, or is it about who you are now and making, recreating yourself, I guess, is what the question I'm trying to ask.
Yeah, I always go into speaking engagements like I'm just like you, because I'm at an age where I can still like relate to the high school students.
Right.
I want them to know like, hey, I know what goes on in high school, but like, this is my story. This is who I was. This is what happened to me. And if it can happen to me, it can happen to you.
Right.
And I never tell them, don't do this, don't do that. It's more of, this is the choices that I made and look where it left me, and let them kind of think for themselves. Because I feel like if you tell them, don't do drugs, don't drink, don't do this, don't do that, like, and tell them not to, their mind is going to be like, well, what if I try it? Instead, I rather show them like, this is what happened to me because of the choices. And I know so many people that have, this one guy, Aaron, he's an amazing, well, I mean, he can't talk anymore, but his mom and him do speaking engagements, and he overdosed on narcotics and they do speaking engagements. And now he's like, he communicates 1, 2, or 3, like, and his mom and him speak. So it's like giving students and teenagers and even college students like the actual like the
reality
truth, the reality and show them to their face what can happen, I think is so much stronger than telling them what to do and what not to do.
So where are you at now, like where is, and at one point do you think you found Chelsea Hill again, and it's a new Chelsea Hill, right?
So
where are you at now?
Right now, I run the world's largest all-girls wheelchair dance team. I have the largest network of women in chairs. I have about 100 women all over the world that are
part of
the Rolettes. And we have a performance dance team of 7 girls, all in wheelchairs, all different types of diagnosis and all wheelchair users. So I found myself again. I have to say, when I found a new passion, a new love for dance, mm-hmm. is when I found myself and realized that, hey, if I can still get that same feeling on the dance floor, then that's all that matters to me.
Yeah.
I had the honor of speaking at the Abilities Expo this past season, and they had children in have their own wheelchair dance teams, which I was like, I mean, the entire time I'm just bawling, because you envision your own children, you envision yourself, you are looking at what is to come for our future. And I think it's so inspiring, and I think it's so beautiful. And I think that I just cheer it on. I want to come to like some concerts. I want to see it all. I want to be your biggest fan.
Yeah. We were talking about badass women this morning, and I was like, the whole time I'm like, I know Chelsea Hill's one of them.
The Abilities Expo is awesome. I actually started dancing that with them with Ati, who is the girl that basically opened up this whole world to me when I was just a year injured. I met her 9 months after my injury, and I remember meeting her and being like, I'm a dancer too, or I was a dancer, and I watched your videos while I was in the hospital. And she goes, you were a dancer? She goes, once a dancer, always a dancer. Aww. And at that moment, I was like, I like still get chills. I'm like, wow, like someone I looked up to while I was in the hospital, yeah. while I was at my lowest points, I met, and she completely like turned around my mindset. And, yeah. you know, a year after that, I danced with her for a year and danced at the Abilities Expos and all the events, and then started my own team up in Northern California.
Good
and
for you.
It was just so amazing to have that support. You
so
know?
If people want to see you and your troupe dance, where do they go?
We have a lot of videos on YouTube. We have a lot of videos on our Instagram, roulettes_LA. And we do a lot of events for fundraisers and just Abilities Expo stuff. But also we do Red Bull events for their Wings for Life nonprofit. And really, if you call, we'll answer. Like, we love performing all over the country. And we performed for like a CP fundraiser in Green Bay. And so we do really anything and everything. And my passion is just to educate people that dance is dance, whether you're walking or you're rolling, and it doesn't matter what you look like. And we just want to share our form of art.
I love that.
Me too. It's so inspiring.
It really is. But you know what? I've seen the pattern is like, there are some people who need that inspiration, right? And most people do, I feel like, where you were like, where your dad would say things and you were like, oh, I can do that. Mm-hmm. And then when you met her and she was like, you're once a dancer, always, oh, you're right. So it is so important that we have role models and we have people to look to in those moments. So yeah. like if anyone's in a dark moment, you're not alone. There's somebody else who's going through it. And thank God for YouTube, because
yeah.
you can, I know even through brain surgery, like before I was YouTubing brain surgeries, I'm like, I want to know what it looks like. What yeah. are they doing to my head when I'm under? How are they spinning me
right.
to do this? So YouTube is an amazing resource to find somebody going through the same thing that you're going through to help inspire you or make you feel less alone mm-hmm. and pull you up, right?
Definitely.
And I know you were on the show Push Girls, right?
Yeah.
So was that, I thought that was on TLC. Was that not on
it
TLC?
It was on Sundance.
Oh, yeah. Sundance. Okay. So I figured that's why I was asking you, Tara, if yeah. you guys had known each other and maybe a part of the network. how was that experience for you?
So I met the girls, all four of them, at a fundraiser in Beverly Hills 9 months after I was injured. And my dad had this bright idea to go to LA and go to this fundraiser. And I was like, okay, sure, why not? And so I go, and that's when I met her. And I remember that next, like 4 months later, she was like, hey, send me a bio and a headshot. And I was like, I'm 18 years old.
What's a bio?
What's a headshot? I was right. like, this is what happened to me. And that's where my story ends, you know? So I sent her like a little bit about what happened to me. Drove down with my dad, met with the producers, had no idea I was meeting with producers, and just had like a dinner. And they're like, you're our missing link. We need someone newly injured. And so I was thrown onto a reality show when I was like a year and a half injured, not knowing. I was just like, sure, yeah, why not?
Sounds good.
Sounds great.
Why and, not? Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like, okay, not really knowing like what it was going to be. And it was the first reality show about people in wheelchairs. And I'm so thankful that I was able to have that platform at such a young injury, because I think it showed me, I had, you know, four big sisters that really took me under their wings, and it really showed me that I can do everything. It taught yeah. me how to travel. It taught me how to schedule my life. And it showed me that I can have a platform and I can reach so many people that are going through hard times or maybe just trying to figure out how to be themselves again. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beauty of social media and the industry that we're all in mm-hmm. is that you can reach someone, you don't know who you're reaching, and you may save someone's life.
Yeah. What are your dreams? What's the future look like for Chelsea Hill?
Oh gosh.
Here I am with the tough questions, guys.
Yeah, for sure. All the deep ones.
My biggest dream, it always reflects back to the Roulettes, because that's like my baby that I created, you know, and I run a wheelchair dance camp for wheelchair users every summer. And I just want it to be, it's called the Roulette Experience. And I want it to be known around the world, which it is now. We have 9 countries attending, which is crazy.
That's
great. But I want it to be bigger. I want to reach everyone in wheelchairs because I don't want anyone to feel alone. I want them to know that they have someone, you know, whether you're in a different country and so far away and only get to use a computer one time, or you're here in LA and you're surrounded by 1,000 women in wheelchairs. Like, I want to have the biggest international convention for people that are wheelchair users and highlight dance. And, you know, of course I want to go on, I mean, I went on tour, but like, I want to go on tour again, and I want to be a backup dancer on like BET. Like, I have so many dreams of mine that I want to achieve. And, you know, I feel like anything is possible as long as I just keep trying and keep trying to break down that barrier. Cause what I'm doing with the Roulettes and the Roulettes Experience and our Be Boundless Summit is so different, and there really is no rule book on how to do it. And so I'm just trying to figure it out.
I love it. Where can people get information on the Roulettes?
You can go to RouletteSdance.com, okay, or you can go to RouletteSexperience.com. We're on all social media, Instagram, YouTube.
Perfect. You can find Chelsea on Instagram and Twitter at Chelsea Hill. Of course, my lovely co-host, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tara Jolet at Tara Jolet. Chelsea, thank you for sharing your story, and thank you for being a bright light for people who need it. Thanks again for joining us on this episode of Conversations with Maria Menounos. Please, please, please don't forget to rate, comment, and subscribe, and tell a friend. In the meantime, follow us at Maria Menounos, at SiriusXM Stars, at Miss Ashley Daniels, at Christie Reports, and remember, everyone, be nice people, make good choices, and be present.